forum, the candidates forum at the Veterans Hall. Hope to see you there if you go. Tomorrow night, Chamber of Commerce will be having its forum. That's the lair of Linda Steinau, the Downtown Association Duchess. That's at City Council at 7 p.m. tomorrow night, so check that one out. A quick tip of the hat to the Parks and Rec for bringing back the benches at City Hall. I hate to say that I have to tip my hat to Kitten Reynolds, but I've got to say, Kitten Reynolds did raise this issue in a speech at City Council, and that has to be noted. There are plenty of other things to be noted about Kitten Reynolds, which would lead me to say, do not associate with her, do not work with her, pay no attention to 95% of what she says. However, on this one occasion, she should be commended. Also want to put in a pitch for jury nullification for all you potential jurors out there. Be advised that you are, as jurors, you do have the right to say no to a judge, to say no, and to say not guilty if you believe that prosecution is vindictive, if you believe that a law is unconstitutional, if you believe that something unfair is happening or that elementary justice is not being served. This is not my idea. This is not my theory. This is constitutional theory that has been the case in the United States for 200 years, but has become essentially overlaid by the judicial tyranny that judges exercise in courts, where they tell you, you're just an arithmetician. All you do is add up the facts. I tell you the law, and even if you disagree with the law, you have to vote in favor of guilty or not guilty based simply on the evidence. That's not true. Don't believe it. Come to your own decisions. If somebody is, you're going to send someone to jail for 20 years for marijuana cultivation, don't do it. You can just say no. You are the fourth branch of the legislature. You are the community. You are the people. And I'm hoping that the jurors in cases like that of Brian Andrus have the guts to say no to overwhelming prosecution resources, which are usually many times those of defense resources. But I'm actually going to be turning over the mic now to Becky Johnson and to her guests, the Petersons, who will be able to kind of give you an direct view of a particular case, the Brian Andrus case, which you've heard about, talked about on this station before. I'm going to return to you on Sunday at 11 o'clock with civil rights updates from around the state, with interviews from the street. But for now, I want to thank you for being with me and pass on the mic to Becky Johnson.
Thanks, Robert. And hello, Free Radio audience. Glad that you've been hearing reports from Robert earlier in the show about what happened in Judge Attuck's court in the last few days regarding this case. In the studio today, we're lucky enough to have with us both eyewitnesses to the shooting of Brian Andrus on March 15th. And Cherie Peterson testified today on the stand. However, her husband, Rick Peterson, who had been requested to by the defense to testify. That was the story that I heard. Let me talk to Rick here. Did the defense request you to testify in the Andrus trial?
Yes. I got subpoenaed to court.
And so why did you not appear on the witness list?
Well, I actually have no idea. No, nobody told me. From what I assume, the prosecutor and the judge probably thought I would be some kind of a hostile witness. I really don't know. I never got an answer.
Right after the March 15th shooting, an investigator from the district attorney's office did visit you and attempt to get a statement. What happened?
Yes, I believe his name was Martin Crowell. He approached me in the driveway the following morning of the shooting. I stayed home from work because I was pretty upset at what I saw. I actually missed a couple days worth of work. But Martin Crowell and one of his associates came up to the driveway and asked if they could question me. And I naturally said, sure. And upon finishing the interview, I was pretty irate and and probably said a lot of nasty things to him because I was pretty upset. But after the interview, he pretty slyly let me know that he was recording me by pulling up his clipboard with a microphone underneath it, and I had no idea he was recording me. He didn't let me know he was recording me. So I was pretty upset about that, and I assume it was because of that interview that they barred me from the courtroom. And I really, really wanted to go up there and be a witness to let them, let the jury know what the truth is.
Well, one of the things that the jury did not hear about so far, and probably will not, was about how Brian was treated after the shooting. I'm going to kind of go in reverse order here and talk with you first about what happened after Brian had been shot and what you saw. This is, you know, testimony that the jury will never get a chance to hear. Sergeant Hennig testified earlier that he went and checked the vital signs of Brian Andrews twice after he had been handcuffed. What would you say about that?
Well, I would say that's false. I was sitting in the audience. When that happened, I saw all four police officers involved in the shooting. I saw all their testimonies. And Officer Hennig did say that he checked Brian's vital signs twice while he was laying on the ground. And from what I saw, that is not the truth. I was standing there right after he basically hit the ground. I stood there until he was taken away in the ambulance. And I personally saw nobody check on him one time. I approached Brian. As soon as I got on the scene, I approached Brian to go assist him, to give him some first aid, because basically I thought he was deceased, and I was going to go over and check on him. And when I walked over on top of him, all four officers very violently escorted me away from the scene and immediately put up yellow tape and wouldn't let nobody assist him. And I saw no officers give him any assistance.
You know, I didn't see that in any of the police reports, any reference to your presence there at that time.
Yeah, it's basically everyone's nobody on the prosecution side wants to hear from me. You know, I saw basically the entire incident after he hit the ground, and you know, I really wish I could have got up there on the stand and told the jury, you know, my side of the story.
Well, what were some of the things that disturbed you about what you saw?
I saw probably the main thing, the main disturbance was the officers' attitudes towards myself, towards the public safety, and towards Brian's welfare. It appeared to me that they didn't care whether he was going to pass away right there on the lawn or not, and I cared very much. And they also really didn't care for the public safety. Although the officers claim that they made sure that there was no citizens in the area before the shooting, which leads me to believe that they knew that there was going to be a shooting because they claim that they told everyone to leave the area.
Now, Cherie, you got to testify today for the defense, and there were several things that you would have liked to have said and didn't either get the opportunity or that that just in the heat of the moment were not said. One of the things that District Attorney Allen made a very large case about was the fact that you were the person who had initially placed a telephone call, not to the 911 line, but to the business line, and that why would you be upset when the police came when you had called them yourself? That question, would you call the police again if these circumstances arose?
I've sat back a long time and thought about what I did calling the police, and I certainly didn't know that it would result to having to witness Brian Andrus being gunned down. And it's unfortunate that I didn't get to say a lot of things in the courtroom that the jury should have heard. One of the things that I would have liked to have an opportunity of, to have said was the fact that after Brian was shot down and once I made it across the street, Brian lay there and he was gasping for air. And his face was getting grayer and grayer and no one was helping him. He was clearly suffering and there wasn't one officer around him that was willing to help him, and nor my husband and I were allowed to help him. And that was really disturbing and something I would have liked to let the jury know.
Another thing that I thought was really significant that didn't come out was that after the shooting had occurred, Lori Andrus went and locked herself back inside the apartment. Now, you placed a phone call to Lori, a woman who you had babysat for her child a few times and knew her, not, she wasn't a close friend of yours, but certainly a fellow neighbor, a mother, and that you had common interests with your children. So what was the nature of that phone call?
As soon as Brian was taken away by ambulance, Lori locked herself into her apartment, so I ran over to my home and phoned Lori, wanted to know if she was okay. She said that she was being forced to go with the police down to the police station, that she didn't want to go, but that she was forced to do so.
You had called her at a time when before the police had actually been able to enter in. I guess they were knocking on the door. Maybe correct me if I'm wrong, but I thought the police were knocking on the door and asking her to open up. They'd already taken Brian off to the hospital and airlifted him to San Jose Medical Center. And in this time period, she did not want to open the door to the police a second time, and you called her, and then she described what had happened when the police came in the door the first time. Particularly this officer Garazio, who she would know his name, but he was the officer that went in first. What did he do to her? What did she say he did to her?
He forced his way in and grabbed her arms and pushed her back, is what I recall her telling me.
Was it painful to her?
Yes, it was. She's a very little person.
Did it cause her to scream?
I don't know.
And so this is something that John Thornton brought out, and hopefully the jury was listening, that here is a man who, looking down the stairs of his house, not aware that the police are there, sees the door open a crack, sees his wife talking to someone at the door, can't see it because the door is only open a crack, and her body is in the doorway covering that crack, and all of a sudden it bursts open. Somebody forces their way in the house, grabs his wife, pushes her back in the living room in a way that was painful to her and may have caused her to scream. Actually, she did say when she spoke to us within probably about a week after the incident, she did say that it caused her to scream, and that Brian was not necessarily aware that these were police officers. The apartment was darkened. because Hannah, the baby, who slept through the tirade, these loud shouting, this man shouting at the top of his lungs, the baby slept through all that, and the baby also slept through the shooting, and even including bullets ricocheting inside the living room, two of them at least, one of them about 3 foot high, and in the back of the apartment near the kitchen, which is not too far from where their child was lay sleeping. And, this is what the picture that Thornton is painting for the jury about what was going on in Brian Andrus's mind, what he was thinking was happening, what he's reacting to, and that given what he knew about the incident, and given, a lot of, one of the issues that came up was, is it reasonable for a person who is inside their home, they're not committing any crime, and the police come knocking on the door and say, we want to come in. Is it reasonable for that person to say, there's no problem going on here, please go away, and refuse entry? Is that reasonable? Did either of you, one of you, want to comment on that issue?
Well, yeah, I feel very strongly opposed to their actions of barging into their apartment. That sort of reflects a police state to me. They have no warrant to go in. There's no crime that was being committed. Yet, apparently, the police officers got away with barging their way into the apartment under protest of the resident. And that's very unfortunate because, we should have the right to say, do we want them invited in or not?
Were either of you able to hear voices, any conversations that occurred before the shooting occurred from either the police or from Brian?
No, I didn't hear anything said.
Well, what do you think about Carol Moore's testimony earlier that she heard Lori Andrus inside of her house saying statements like, I'm fine, please go away?
I don't see how Carol Moore could have heard anything Lori Andrus had to say. She was clear across the street, and the police claimed that they didn't hear anything either, so I'm real leery on what a lot of things Carol Moore had to say.
Well, she also said that the reason that she was moving out of the Button Street neighborhood was because it was such a bad neighborhood. That was the reason that she was moving out.
And Officer Grazio also claimed that officers are very skeptical to go into the apartments because of heavy gang activity going on at Button Street Apartments. I've lived there for 13 years, and I haven't seen one gang in 13 years. So he is painting a very ugly picture of Button Street, and that's very unfortunate.
And why was Carol Moore moving out?
I spoke with her landlord, and she was being evicted from her place, and not because the neighborhood was so bad. So that was actually a lie.
I spoke to Carol Moore briefly outside the court, but she did mention that that her husband was a lawyer, and that she was, or her ex-husband was a lawyer, and that she's dating a sheriff. So, she was an eyewitness that was called in for the prosecution, but she gave a very convincing testimony. It's going to be difficult for John Thornton to really refute a lot of the things that Carol Moore said. She said that when Brian had first arrived at the house and he'd gotten out of the car, that he was screaming, "You fucking bitch," over and over at Lori. Did you, either of you, have any knowledge of the content of what Brian's statements were that you know, I mean, it caused you to make a concern call to the police and another neighbor to call 911. Do you know anything?
No, I sure don't. I didn't hear Brian say anything like that. No, not that I'm aware of. Aaron Cantrell and Josh Kirby evidently were right there, and I didn't hear them say that Brian said anything like that.
What Lori Andrus, who was kind enough to speak to us after the shooting had occurred, and she... switch to something else that concerned me. I did some of the videotaping of this scene, and where Brian's body landed was, and where the bullet casings are, it was like 10 to 15 feet apart from what I could tell. And yet, you testified that it was, I think you said 8 to 10 feet, or perhaps even 6 to 8 feet. How close were the police when Brian was fired upon?
That's just an estimation, 6 to 8 feet. I would have to actually go down with a tape measure and measure how far away the police were. I do know that the police testified that Brian was coming at them, but at the time that I saw Brian, he was standing on the sidewalk, and then he was fired upon, and from what I could see, the police were not in any immediate danger.
At the moment when they fired on him, and you could see at least the lower portion of Brian, and you could see where the police were relative, at least three of the police officers relative where Brian was, could a person physically have swung a baseball bat from that position and made contact with the officers where they were?
Absolutely not. He would have had to throw the bat down the sidewalk at the officers, and clearly he was not swinging a bat at them at the time that he was gunned down.
One of the officers who was on the scene, Sergeant Hennig, was at the gateway into the little patio area in front of the residence at 67 Button Street there. And he said that he had just arrived right about the time that Lori opened the door, and he saw Officer Grazio push the door open and enter the apartment. However, he said he did not witness Brian strike Officer Zemanek in the chest. He later radioed shortly after the shooting occurred. He radioed in that someone radioed that shots had been fired, and then somebody else radioed in that I think it was code 4 or something, that no officers were injured. That was Hennig that made that. Radioed in that this code 4, that no officers were injured. And he explained it in the court that he didn't even notice that Zemanek had gone over and was standing, leaning against the back wall, kind of holding his chest, and that was when he realized that he'd been injured. One wonders, if he was standing there watching the door continuously, why didn't he see Brian hitting Zemanek in the chest? If he did see him hit him in the chest, why did he radio code 4, you know, that no officers were injured? Could this officer, I mean, you saw them where the officers were. So one of those three officers that you saw, probably the one closest to the gate, according to Hennig's testimony, could he have seen, been in a position to see what was occurring at the front doorstep? Could you see which officer was closest to the patio area? Okay. Well, I don't know. It's a conundrum. It just doesn't add up. I mean, it's really can't be explained how those two facts could both be true. Another thing that hasn't come out yet and may not, I don't know if John Thornton will bring it out or not, and that was the medical reports that occurred from Dominican Hospital for the two injured officers. Now, I had occasion to see those reports, and the release date that the doctor released the two officers so that they could return to work was the same day that they were seen at Dominican. Both officers were released to go back to work the next day. However, Zemanek testified that he had missed 4 weeks of work, and Garazio testified that he collected workman's comp for 3 days. He bloodied his fingernail. You know anything about the injuries of the officers?
No, I don't. I wish I knew more from what. Yeah, when I approached the scene, Brian was laying on the ground. I saw all four officers, and none of them appeared to be injured. I did not see any of them leaning against the wall, as testified. So, later on that night, it came to me as a great surprise that there actually had been injuries suffered by the officers, because I most surely didn't witness that.
Well, thank you, Rick and Cherie Peterson, for being with us here at 96.3 FM and to talk about this Andrus trial. And the trial resumes next Monday, 1:30 p.m. in Judge Attucks Court. Thanks. You've been listening to Bathrobes PR's Broadsides, and coming up is Dennis. Uncle Dennis with Earth First Radio, and so we'll be listening to that.
Well, I'm driving on down to the Surfside Bar. These days my old shovel head, she don't travel far, but she goes where I want. Now I want to be where all the lovers go to keep each other. They all drive Chevy pickups in the morning. They all ride Harley Davidsons at night. They all work for somebody who makes all the money and pays them just enough to get tight in the house of Boulay. Woman there, she got the long legs of Brenda Nelson, golden hair. She knows that's what to do to make a man feel good. She's the hardest working woman in this neighborhood. She don't mind making breakfast in the morning. She don't mind.
To Free Radio Santa Cruz 96.3 FM, and it's time for Earth First Radio with Uncle Dennis. Lots of news and stuff tonight. Unfortunately, most of it's about the murder of David Chain.
Animal your friends are on the run. There's nowhere to go when the job is done. How can he stand by while the song takes place? We've got to stop listening to you and me.
CD, Keep It Wild. You're tuned to Free Radio Santa Cruz. I'm Uncle Dennis, and you're listening to Earth First Radio every Thursday night at 8 o'clock. And we start off with announcements, and then we're going to move into our lead story of the night, which is the murder of David Chain by a Pacific lumber logger. And the events surrounding that in the last week, things that have come to light, the rally today in Eureka, and various other things. We've got, in addition, news from the Forest Service, activism around the world, things that are happening in Congress, and lots of other stuff. So let's get started here. One thing I want to remind all my listeners to do is to get yourself a piece of paper and a pencil or a pen. Hopefully it's recycled paper, but use whatever you have to, because one thing about Earth First Radio is it's activist radio. It's radio where you can make a difference if you take the effort to do so. You need to take down some information every now and again while listening to this show to be effective listeners. That's what Earth First Radio is about. I present the information that I've gleaned from various sources during the past week, and usually that information has telephone numbers of people to call, people for information, people you can call to let your voice be heard, people who can make a difference. The movers and shakers of the world all have telephones. They all have fax machines. Most of them have email. They all have addresses. And you can write to them, you can fax them, you can send them stuff. And hopefully it will make a difference. Maybe it won't, but it certainly won't make a difference if you don't try. So get your implement of inscription out and something to inscribe upon, because it's time for announcements. All right, the first is an announcement that we've been making for a few weeks now concerning the black-tailed prairie dog. This is a chance where you can save these furry little critters from extinction. They have less than 1% of their original habitat left. The U.S. Fish and Wildlife Service says that these little prairie dogs are in danger of extinction, and what we need is a ruling on the Endangered Species Act to list the prairie dogs as threatened under the Endangered Species Act. The prairie dog is not protected now. In fact, in many states it's still considered to be vermin. And folks can go out and do recreational shooting and poisoning. These things continue even though the black-footed ferret and many other species rely on the prairie dog for their prey species. We need to keep this ecosystem alive. You can make a difference. Here's what you do. You write a letter. It doesn't have to be a real long letter. It can be a short letter. It can have as little as 3 sentences in it. Here are those sentences. The first is, you are writing in support of listing of the black-tailed prairie dog as a threatened species under the Endangered Species Act. Here's your data. The most recent scientific data and the latest black-tailed prairie dog population surveys strongly suggest that the protection of the prairie dog under the Endangered Species Act is necessary now. The third letter, request that your letter be included in the administrative record, and you would like the Fish and Wildlife Service to respond to your letter and explain their position on protecting the black-tailed prairie dog. Here's who you write to. Jamie Clark, Director of the U.S. Fish and Wildlife Service, 1849 C Street, Northwest, Washington, D.C., 20240. I'll give you that address again. Jamie Clark, Director of the U.S. Fish and Wildlife Service, which you can abbreviate USFWS, 1849 C Street, Northwest, Washington, D.C., 20240. You can also send email. Email address is jamie_clark@mail.fws.gov. I will spell that all out for you. jamie_clark@mail.fws.gov. jamie_clark@mail.fws.gov. You can also write a letter to your local newspaper, get other people to write letters, and by all means, contact your senators and representatives in Congress. Tell them that you support the listing of the black-tailed prairie dog as a threatened species under the Endangered Species Act. Very simple, easy to do. Okay, here's a calendar of upcoming events. The only upcoming event that's on this is Public Lands Day, which is this Saturday. Here's the phone call to find out what's happening on Public Lands Day. You can call 202-628-8200, extension 24. That phone number again is 202-628-8200, extension 24, for more information about activities in your area. And the person you'll be talking to is Patty Pride. Also like to mention that you should probably already be in Minnesota for the Zero Cut Action Camp. The Zero Cut Action Camp is being held from September 27th, this Sunday, through October 4th, that's a week from this Sunday, in Geneva, Minnesota, just 90 miles south of Minneapolis, St. Paul. The Zero Cut campaign encompasses legislative, litigative, and media-based components, and you'll learn how to do all that at the Ruckus Society Zero Cut Action Camp next week, starting this Sunday, in Geneva, Minnesota. If you'd like phone information, there's still time to fly out there, by the way. You can phone 510-848-9565. That's 848-9565. You've got to get your butt there, but the camp is free. They would like a donation if you can make one. Again, the number is 510-848-9565, or you can email ruckus@ruckus.org. That's R-U-C-K-U-S at ruckus.org. And I guess that's about it for that one, because by the time next week rolls around here at Uncle Dennis's show, all those announcements won't be pertinent anymore. Here's an announcement from Greenpeace of Canada. Every day, the Greenpeace team will be documenting the Great Bear Rainforest on the west coast of Canada and uploading reports and images to Greenpeace websites around the world. As the ship Freedom Dancer sails up the coast of British Columbia, we will show you the beauty of Canada's rainforest, introduce you to the First Nations people of the region, and show you current clear-cut logging which is destroying this fragile ecosystem. Here's how you can go along on this tour for absolutely just the cost of a phone call. Set your web browser to www.greenpeacecanada, all one word, greenpeacecanada.org, and get yourself on the Great Bear Rainforest tour. There's a whole lot here about that. I'm not going to read it to you. If you've got an internet account and you want to point your web browser at www.greenpeacecanada.org, you'll certainly find out what's going on here. For those folks who don't have internet access, get down to the library, the Santa Cruz Public Library, and get on there and you can browse the web for free. Okay? Doesn't even cost you anything. You don't have to have a computer. They've got them there. www.greenpeacecanada, all one word, .org. Coming up this weekend, September 25th and 26th, that's tomorrow and Saturday, I believe Friday and Saturday at 7:30 p.m., is the Doug Thron Headwaters Slideshow. Let me tell you, this is really a wonderful slideshow, if it's half as great as the last time Doug Thron was in Santa Cruz. It'll be absolutely wonderful. Doug Thron is a photographer. He's just a marvelous photographer, and his thing is the Headwaters Forest. This is a multimedia slideshow, and along with Doug Thron will be the highly acclaimed nature writer Joan Dunning. She and Doug have created a provocative new book about headwaters entitled From the Redwood Forest. Joan will read excerpts from this book, and you won't want to miss this presentation. It is free to tomorrow and Saturday, September 25th and 26th at 7:30 p.m. at the Loudon Nelson Center Auditorium. Again, this event is co-sponsored by the Sierra Club, Santa Cruz Group, and Citizens for Responsible Forest Management. Some fine folks. And I will put this in the announcements log so other people can do it. Okay, other things that are coming up. If you happen to be in Redway tomorrow night, there's the Laura Love Concert, a benefit for Earth First, the Trees Foundation, and the Environmental Protection Information Center. That's happening at the Mateel Community Center in Redway. Coming up this Sunday at the Greek Theater in Berkeley is Bonnie Raitt and Ulu Dada. This is a benefit for the Rainforest Action Network, the Trees Foundation, the Headwaters Action Video Collective, Earth First, Environmentally Sound Promotions, and the Bay Area Coalition for Headwaters. There are special tickets available, which I'm sure cost more than the regular tickets, but you get to go, you get great seats and an after-show reception with Bonnie Raitt and Ulu Dada. For more information, call the Rainforest Action Network at 415-392-4404. That's 415-392-4404. I'm sure you can get tickets at all the major outlets. That's this Sunday at 3 p.m. Bonnie Raitt and Ulu Dada benefit for a whole bunch of folks. A week from this Sunday, October 4th, is the next fight for Headwaters Forest Politics versus Science. It is a whole bunch of stuff happening in Berkeley at the Martin Luther King Jr. Middle School Auditorium, 1781 Rose in Berkeley. It's near North Berkeley BART. There's free parking. Sliding scale donations will be asked at the door. David Brower, Congressman George Miller will be speaking. Doug Thron's slideshow will be there.